There's a lot of dramatic speech being put out there nowadays, and I do believe it has been stepped up quite a bit. Does it ever have some of you thinking more along the lines of, it's harder than ever to defend your Christian faith? Well, whether you've always found it easy or you found it challenging to defend your faith, I want to take you back to a conversation that I had with Dr. Stephen Cutchins, who addressed that very issue. We need to be able to do that more now than we may have had to do even 20, 30 years ago. And as time goes on, hello and welcome to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr., where you are just in time to go on another journey. It's going to be a mental journey. It's going to be a spiritual journey. It's about spiritual perspectives. As we have our guest, yours and mine, Dr. Stephen Cutchins, joining us today to help us with something that a lot of us have been wanting some help with for a long time, and that is how we go about intelligently, tactfully, yet mightily defending the faith that means so much to so many of us. Our guest, Dr. Stephen Cutchins, is going to talk us through that. So be ready to take your notes. You got your iPads, you got your whatever you have. Even if it's pen and paper, that's okay. I still use pen and paper. I kind of like old school. It's easier for me. But however you want to do it, be ready to take your notes. Dr. Cutchins, it's so great to have you with us. How you doing?
Thank you, Carl. I'm doing really well. It's a great joy to be able to just sit in the room with you and have a conversation with you. You and I have developed a really good friendship over the last year. And, this is going to be a great joy. It's going to be a great joy. This is one of the topics that I love to talk about because things have really changed over the years. Just recently, I heard a statistic that said that 65% of the people in America, 65% of the people in our country, Carl, no longer believe that absolute truth exists. In other words, they don't believe that there's anything that's they either believe it's not true, that they think that there's nothing that's true, or that even if there is something out there that we can't know it. What that means is, Carl, you and I are in the minority here, and that we are in that 35% of people that actually hold to the simple idea that there are things that are true for all people in all places at all times. But this is countercultural in our country today. Have you seen that?
And I have, and it's so interesting because decades ago, that was not the case.
No.
That the majority of Americans say there is no absolute truth.
Well, and what you wind up having is a lot of situations where you got fake news and you got all these different things going on because there's no gauge that is agreed upon by the majority of our culture anymore of what is truth or that truth even exists. So what we live in is we live in a perpetual just collision of people's opinions and perceptions of things with nothing objective and solid to really gauge whether those things are accurate or not. And for me, one of the fundamentals of defending our faith is backing up and saying, all right, well, let's don't start with the resurrection of Christ. Let's back up for a minute and let's not even talk about whether God exists. Let's back up really to this core issue of truth. If a person doesn't believe that truth exists, then we're kind of spinning our wheels with no traction talking to them about whether the resurrection is true or not. Whether we're talking about whether the Bible is true or not doesn't really have a file folder or a landing place in those people's minds and in their hearts, because if they don't believe that there is anything that's true, then we're talking about something that really has no landing place for them. So we've got to establish that truth exists. And if we don't do that, then we really have no common ground to stand on.
You know, you mentioned that, and I'm reminded of a conversation I had some years ago, maybe close to 15, 20 years ago. A lady was challenging me about truth. And she said, all truth is relative. And then she made it a point. There is no truth. And she's a beautiful young lady. And I started to say this to her, and for whatever reason decided, now I think it's because I didn't want to just back her into a corner, but this is what I started to share with her. And I told her, I hear you loud and clear, but let me ask you this, and this is what I wanted to say. You're leaving the grocery store. You get to your car, put the last bag in your car. It's 9:30 at night. It's dark out in the parking lot. You turn around to put your buggy up, and as soon as you turn around, you get hit in the face. Bam! Next thing you know, you're waking up in the woods somewhere. Some guy knocked you out, took you to those woods, and raped you. Now, if you were to tell that story, I would say he was wrong for having done that to you. But you would counter, no, you can't say he was wrong, because you're treating that as though that's a true statement, that he did me wrong. There is no truth. And so you and I would disagree on that whole issue around the matter of truth. Is it true that he was wrong or not? I would say, yes, he was wrong. You would challenge me and say, you can't say that because all truth is relative.
That's right. I mean, and this is something you deal with in your neighborhood sometimes, man. Maybe not something as strong of an issue as what you just talked about, but just anything that has to do with morality. In other words, what we ought not to do. Morality has to have some objective truth from which we know what is the thing that we ought to do or ought not to do. And so, you know, Carl, your story is a great one to tee me up for what I wanted to say here, because even before you track out a situation like that, just with what the lady said, she said to you that there is no truth.
Yes.
Well, the problem with that is that she is assuming that what she's saying is a true statement, right? So if somebody comes to you or me and they say, hey, man, there's no truth out there. Well, the question I always ask is just simply, well, is that a true statement?
There you go.
Because what you've done when you reply that way is you force them into a situation where they absolutely must answer a yes or no question. Yeah. When they say there is no truth, and I come back to them or you come back to me and you say, well, is that a true statement? It's either yes or no. Mm-hmm. And the problem that they're stuck in now, talking about backing somebody in a corner, is that either way they answer, they show that there is an internal conflict with what they're saying. So if they say to me, there is no truth, and I say, well, is that a true statement? Well, if they say no, well, then they're admitting that what they're saying is wrong.
That's right.
And why would I listen to them? But if they answer yes, they've got a problem too. If they say there is no truth and I say, well, is that a true statement? And they say, well, yes. Well, then they've affirmed that truth exists because they're assuming that their statement is true. So we want our statements to be true, but we don't want everyone's statements to be true. And so we have to have some kind of objective thing outside of ourselves that we can hold on to. It's not that we need to make something up that's true. We don't decide what truth is. We discover what the truth is. And I think truth is just simply this. Man, I can't put it any simpler than this. And this is what I say in my book. Truth is just telling it like it is. That's all it is. If you're telling it like it actually is, then you're telling the truth. It's what corresponds with reality. It's the way things really are. And you don't have to be a brain scientist to understand the way things really are, man. This is something you can deal with anywhere. You know, I shave my head, man. If I were to look at you and I, you know, a bald man across the table from you here, and I were to say, hey, man, I got a great head of hair. Well, that doesn't line up with the truth, does it, Carl? You can bear witness to that, right? You can look at me. You could, you know, rub my head if you wanted to. You can see that ain't a great head of hair
no
I got. Now, you might say I got a beautiful bald head, and that might be closer to what the truth is. But, you know, if something you say doesn't line up with the way things really are, then what you're telling is something that is a falsehood. It's not a truth. So the fundamental aspect of defending our faith, I think, in our culture today, with our kids, with our grandkids, with our neighbors, even in our churches, if we're going to defend the Christian faith, we have to start by defending truth itself and come in there and say, look, we have to make sure that we're clear on one thing, that truth does exist, that the opposite of truth is falsehood. And even further, I can know what the truth is. And once I discover what the truth is, anything that opposes it or is the opposite of it has to be a falsehood. That makes sense what
that
I'm saying?
That makes plenty of sense.
Yeah.
And we can actually get comfortable with the notion that, number one, truth does exist. And number two, we can discover it. And number three, we can discuss it.
That's right. That's right. And that's the common ground we have to have in order to have conversations about our faith.
So, Dr. Cutchins, before we move further into that, I got to ask you this. 65%, as you mentioned.
That's a large number, isn't it?
That is a large number. And that's just our country. The country that so many people call a Christian nation say there is no truth. I'm saying that to ask this. How did we get here where a place that is called a Christian nation has the vast majority of the people saying there is no truth? How did Christians get to a point where those of us who truly believe truth exists are in the minority?
Well, I think that what we're discovering here in America is what we've seen in history as well. You know, there's been many nations that have had a struggle with an understanding of objective truth, many cultures. I think that some of the contributing factors that we have from a Christian standpoint that have caused deviations from Christianity and false religions to kind of grow up and evolve is what I would call the unpaid bills of the church. You know, Carl, you and I both have bills to pay.
Yes, sir.
Right? That's right. One thing we're going to have to do. We have to pay some bills.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, there's all kinds of bills. You got your car bill. You got your house bill. You got your electric bill. Mm-hmm. You got your water bill. I mean, everybody's got bills.
Yes, sir.
And the church has bills, too, not just like financial bills, but the bills that come due with the tasks of the church. And so the church has a specific task. You know, we're talking about Christianity here, and the Christian church has the task of making disciples that make disciples. And that's a simple thing to say, but it is something that is real simple to mess up on and to avoid. You know, we have to be teaching these things to our kids. Mm-hmm. We're only one generation away at any moment from being a non-Christian nation. In fact, I've heard leaders in our Christian faith say that we don't live in a non-Christian nation anymore. We live in an anti-Christian nation. You know, in fact, we've heard key leaders in our country say publicly that this is not a Christian nation. And so we have some unpaid bills in our church that we haven't paid. And, you know, you think about, like, I mean, let's just keep it simple, right? If you don't pay your electric bill, what's going to happen?
Eventually,
that electricity is going to go off.
Yes, sir.
And you're going to be sitting in the dark.
That's right.
Am I right?
You're right?
It doesn't matter who you are. You're going to have to pay that electric bill. And if at some point you don't pay that electric bill consistently and for long enough, somebody is going to figure that out and turn your electricity off, and you're going to be sitting in the dark. You got to pay your bills. And that's what I see happening in our culture. There are some fundamentals of our faith, just the basics of our faith that we're not consistently passing on to the next generations in a way that they're absorbing. And so what we have is literally the lights going out. And we are sitting in the darkness. The darkness is not a physical darkness like we're going to have later today with the eclipse. Yeah. It's a spiritual darkness, right? It's a spiritual darkness where the truth, you know, Scripture always calls truth and parallels it with light. And the truth is getting suppressed. And what we're living in is a very dark moment in regard to truth.
Our guest, yours and mine, is Dr. Stephen Cutchins. He is currently interim pastor at First Baptist Church, North Augusta. He's written a book entitled Prove It, Defend the Christian Faith. He's sharing principles with us from that powerful book right now. There's more. And I wanted to let you know that so that you would not be going through the rest of our conversation wondering, oh, man, I can't commit all that to memory. How do I put this into play and I can't remember it all? Don't worry. You don't have to commit it all to memory. You don't even have to take notes like I mentioned from the beginning. We will be sharing with you how to get the book. Again, it is Prove It, Defend the Christian Faith. Our guest, yours and mine, Dr. Stephen Cutchins, and I will be right back.
It's the rescue from the wreckage. It's the shelter from the storm. An array of brilliant colors in a world that's dark and torn. In the middle of the chaos, Lord, remind my heart of this. I can rest here in your promise, 'cause that's what love is.